It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Today you're joining me on a special farm, a farm that's in the middle of a metropolitan population of 4 million people around the San Francisco Bay. This isn't the neighborhood for millennial techies of Silicon Valley. It's Richmond, California, an area that is disadvantaged compared to the wealthier parts of the Bay Area, with some serious issues, crime, poverty, and poor food choices. But progress is happening here, in part due to gardens and farms that are providing a source of community pride to go with the healthy foods grown by volunteers and staff of Urban Tilth. Urban Tilth is a nonprofit community-based organization that is dedicated to cultivating a more sustainable and just food system. I'm visiting with Executive Director Doria Robinson. Her family came to Richmond from the Deep South in the 1940s, along with other families seeking a better life. She grew up in Richmond thinking, like many others did, that someday she'd get out of Richmond. But after college in the East and moving to San Francisco, she came home to Richmond to become an unlikely farmer. It's an intriguing journey from child to community leader and farmer.
When you grow up in a community like this, there's the kind of an internal world,
right?
You know, where you're just kind of hanging out with your friends and, you know, you're on your block and, you know, it's just all the dramas from, you know, kid world. And then there's the external world where you go outside of your neighborhood and people tell you about how you're...
Well, let's put it all together now. So what's Urban Tilth?
Right. So Urban Tilth is this mission to reconnect people to land, and not just land, but biological processes, you know, to good stewardship, to all of the activities that are necessary in order to keep something like soil in good tilth.
So how do you come to be in Richmond, California?
Right.
How does this organization get established?
Right. So actually, you know, everyone thinks I'm the founder of Urban Tilth, and I'm not. I have to definitely always give just props to Park Guthrie, who had the vision to come to this place that had a lot of the right things wrong with it and say, you know, we can actually grow our own. We can grow the food that we need to nurture our bodies, and we can grow the community that we need to nurture kind of our souls, you know. And so he came here, started an organization. He was kind of a one-man show with this vision that he kind of just put out to the world. And I actually... you know, received one of his visionary emails and became a volunteer, and, you know, kind of the journey went on from there. But, you know, the idea is that Richmond is a really unique place, right? Yes, we're in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's very urban. Richmond is really hard hit in terms of, you know, having, you know, very low income people. It's a majority minority city. There's areas of Richmond that are some of the poorest areas in the state of California. Very, very low income, very low graduation rates, very, you know, one grocery store, major grocery store for 100,000 people. A lot of things, a lot of challenges, high crime rates, things like that. But it also has other things that are really powerful. You know, it has this amazing community of people who have come here from the American South. You know, a lot of African Americans came up from the South, had agricultural backgrounds, grew up on farms, the grandparents and whatnot, garden regularly, have a connection, like at least a memory of connection to land. And then a lot of folks coming up from Central America, from Mexico, from all other places, from Southeast Asia, again, from farming backgrounds, and kind of converging in this space and being forced into very, very low-waged jobs, kind of at the bottom of the kind of service industry, and left without a lot of hope. You know, that's, you know, if people have jobs, they're usually in the kind of low-wage job. And so you have people, you know, who are underemployed. You have people who are unemployed. You have areas of Richmond for many, many years that have been completely undeveloped. So lots of vacant lots, lots of places that are just forgotten, like whole areas. The farm that we're sitting on now is a 3-acre lot that was vacant for 40 years, you know, and a lot of public land as well, where the public agencies actually don't have the money to do anything with the land that they have. We don't have those kind of resources in general fund budgets. And so Urban Tilth kind of saw all those kind of right things wrong with it, you know, and said, you know, people need food. We also have very high rates of kind of preventable disease, diabetes, heart disease, obesity, in this community. You know, people need food, not just calories, but real food, high quality food. Mm-hmm. People need jobs. And we have all this vacant land that no one can really afford to do anything with. It's kind of like the combination to let's put people to work growing the food that they need and solve some problems and build some community.
You know, I've had a conversation like this with projects in Detroit.
Right.
And it seemed like they had acres and acres of empty lots.
Yep.
And that was one place that they started too. I don't know. Yeah. Did they start before you did in Richmond? Or?
You know, I'm not quite sure if who started first, but we definitely looked to Detroit, especially the folks at D-Town Farm and whatnot for inspiration and guidance. We've done exchanges with them. It's been really inspiring to see they're able to do things even on a whole other scale because they have so much more land. Because I think the scale of the crisis that they're experiencing is just on a whole other level than kind of Richmond, you know. But
is there a network of people like yourself that are putting these projects together in Detroit and other cities? Are you
right.
able to,
yeah.
to communicate and you know share information right. with each other?
We definitely do. I mean, I think that sometimes there's formal networks. There's a few things like the we have the Food Sovereignty, U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance, and a lot of folks communicate through that network. There's the Climate Justice Alliance. A lot of us are members of the Climate Justice Alliance. So there's a few kind of organized alliances, but there's also, it's kind of even nationally, a small community of people who are relatively small community people who are really, really trying to make a difference with this. You know, we're not kind of pussyfooting around. We're really trying to grow real amounts of food that affect people's lives and change economies. And, you know, over time you get to know each other, you know, you stick around for 5 years and then you start to meet everyone and try to keep in touch and exchange ideas. So I think there's a lot of, you know, a good amount of exchange. There always can be more, but you know, there's a struggle between the work you got to do on the ground and keeping in touch with people.
So did it start here with, you know, the vision and get like one garden going?
Yeah.
And then you're up to 7 gardens. And now, right. When does a garden become a farm?
Right, right, right.
It's a size issue.
Well, it's so, yes, we started with one vision of the Greenway. Richmond Greenway is a rails to trails conversion project, 23 blocks of City Park in Richmond. And Park sent out this email describing, you know, that this place could be transformed with a whole series of gardens for 23 blocks, you know. And you could just walk out and have organically grown produce. You know, this is one of the hardest areas called the Iron Triangle that this City Park goes through, where, you know, people are really desperate and they need help, you know. And he's like, you can just have food growing that people could just come and get, you know. And one of the places that he kind of envisioned in that was called Berryland. It's like a berry garden, yeah. You know, of all these different varieties of berries. And he's like, the kids could come, and because it's, you know, without chemicals, they could just come and graze, you know, and yeah. eat berries. And so that's actually our first garden was Berryland on the Richmond Greenway. It exists today. It's 12 years later. And we grew from that. Actually, we grew more gardens. We went to 13. And then we're like, okay, that's too big. And kind of passed back gardens to different community organizations and then kind of settled on 7. And I think for us, the difference between our gardens and our farms is the farms are really primarily for production. You know, mm-hmm. We definitely do, you know, different programs and, you know, have community events and things like that. But we're growing food to put on people's tables, to make dinners and lunches and breakfasts and whatnot. It's not cutesy. It's not so people can taste the difference. It's not anything like that. Right. So we have two farms that are production for our CSA. We have 98 members right now in our CSA that we launched formally last year. We had a kind of informal thing before that. And then the gardens are, all of our gardens exist without fences. So we have a very a strong principle that food is a human right. And so we kind of do these pop-up gardens in the middle of neighborhoods, and they're communally run, you know, communally managed. And so anyone can walk up at any time and harvest anything.
Well, that's incredible.
Yeah.
So even if they don't do the work, I mean,
If they don't do the work, the point is that food, you know, this is this magical thing that happens with seeds. Uh-huh. They produce a lot of food. And, you know, if there's just a handful of people who, you know, kind of tend mm-hmm. to it on a regular basis, it can make food for many, many more.
So who does work on them? I mean, right. They got to be planted, and you got to hoe them mm-hmm. and water them and all those things you do to plants.
Right.
Who takes care of these?
Right. So one of the things is, you know, a lot of people think that Urban Health is run completely by volunteers. They see a lot of young people. They think they're all volunteering. It's not true. Urban Health actually has 32 staff members. Many of them are youth that have come through our programs and stayed with us for over like 9-10 years and to become, you know, different managers of farms and whatnot. So we have at each site a core team, usually like 2 or 3 people who are assigned to that site to make sure that things are getting watered and weeded and planted at the right time and things like that. But they're supported definitely by many, many community members who come out for volunteer days, who just stop as they're walking by and go, oh, let me help you fill that bed. Or what are you doing? You're doing irrigation. I know how to do that. You know, actually, we're just putting in the irrigation on a new citrus orchard over on the Greenway. And literally a guy who had been riding his bike, you know, down the bike path for, 2-3 weeks saying, I'm going to stop and help. He jumped off his bike and he's like, today is the day. and he was with us for an hour, you know, laying irrigation and talking and hanging out and whatnot. You know, over the course of the year, we get over 2,000 volunteers, all, you know, community members, some organized groups, definitely, but mostly just community members who see what we're doing, have had some of the food, and they're like, let me throw in.
You know, in some communities, it seems like the gardens are helping people get on their feet that have had problems, or mm-hmm. In some cases, it's homeless mm-hmm. That are getting involved in the right. gardens, and they're helping them, and they're also helping them kind of transition to something else as well. Right. Is there any of that element in
right.
your work?
I mean, many of the folks that work for Urban Tilth are people who have barriers to employment, you know? Some people are reentering from incarceration, reentering community. Some people are just, you know, out of high school for one reason or another, and they're just not on a college track. You know, they're trying to get a job, and their options are, you know, kind of Taco Bell if they're lucky, or Urban Health, you know. And I think that we create just another pathway for people who are in a really, really tough financial positions and don't have a lot of options, and have not been supported at, you know, very well at all on kind of thinking that there's an academic kind of future for them. Young people especially, and some older people come to us and you know, new pathway opens up. You know, they get involved not just in the maintenance of the gardens, but right. we really go kind of hard on, you know, the why and the what of what's happening in organic gardening. So we bring up the science and we make sure they understand it so they can kind of communicate that as we're out with people. Right. Like, why are we doing drip irrigation instead of, you know, sprinklers? And, you know, why are we mulching? Why are we doing all these things? We get into the why behind it and try to connect that back to larger issues to, you know, create a way where people can just have a moment, you know, with this earth that has all these lessons to learn and possibly just get turned back on. I think a lot of things in urban communities, especially in inner city communities, can really turn people off, yeah. you know, like the amount of trauma, the amount of pressures, you know, really just turn people off as a defense mechanism.
So you're there for right. them when they may need it.
Right.
And they can connect and get recharged and refocused and have a maybe find a purpose in life. They transition on then to something else. I mean, they've had some time. They've worked with you. They've been involved with the gardens or the farms. And then maybe they find a job somewhere else. But it's touched them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's different. Different people. So, you know, we're kind of proud. So some of the folks that came into us and they came in, you know, started with us, they didn't think they were going to, they didn't know what they were going to do. They end up going, you know, taking a chance, going back to community college. A few of them transferred to UCs, gotten degrees. You know, a few of them are now teaching in the schools that we actually found them in when we first started. Some are, you know, kind of getting involved in local politics. One person, Tanya Polito, who is just, you know, just one of our, I don't know, one of those people that come in contact with an organization and they just really take it and run. She's actually running one of the county's programs to just revitalize the whole of North Richmond, and is being, you know, just really involved and really showing up as a leader in the community. So, you know, people have gone off to the South, back to Atlanta, and helped to start programs in juvenile facilities, garden programs. And, you know, people are on their pathways. They're doing different things. I tell you that most people are doing something, and they're not just sitting on the couch somewhere under a screen, you know.
You know, it would seem to me that when a community has this much going on, that this would affect the community's self-image. I would think that people that aren't even directly involved would feel a sense of pride that there is this self-help effort going on in the community.
Right. And I think that Urban Tilth is just one piece of a larger story of things that are happening in Richmond. But definitely, there was this moment, actually, when we were making our first T-shirts for Urban Tilth, you know, and we all said that, you know, it wasn't enough to have just about, you know, gardening and grow your own has kind of been our tagline, a little funny and whatnot. And because we mean food and other people mean other things. Right. and we made a point to put Richmond, California on it, you know, because, you know, most of the staff have grown up in inner city areas of Richmond, and it's always been shameful to be from Richmond.
Right.
And we were like, you know, no, we're turning that, on a dime. We're turning it over. You know, like this is, we're proud to be from here, you know?
Well, you're from here. What? Right. And I would imagine when you were a little girl growing up in Richmond, you didn't imagine you'd be farming in Richmond someday or working with a garden.
I don't think that would have even approached the realm of possibility for me. But I do have to say that I grew up with this community from the South. My family's from Louisiana and Arkansas. And they came up from the South with 17 other families.
Really?
And yeah, you know, and they, you know, my grandfather's a minister, you know, brought the church kind of, well, started a church up here, had some really interesting philosophies around community and how community kind of pulls together to create the situations that they needed to, you know, thrive. So one of the things that they did when they came up, even though none of them were wealthy people, these are like, you know, small town, you know, farmer type folk. They pulled their money together and they bought land in Fairfield, California. So when I was growing up, we would go up to the ranch in Fairfield. It was 350 acres and they all ran it. They had a cattle ranch. They had a whole kind of farming operation and hogs and like, you know, we had turkeys fresh for Thanksgiving, you know, and it was a, you know, really interesting kind of juxtaposition between this kind of, you know, 1980s, 1990s inner city, lots of shooting kind of neighborhood, and then weekends with the Southerners, you know, with the family, you know, plucking turkeys and, I mean, chickens and growing food. I never really realized what impact it was making at the time. For me, that was more like, well, I'm learning to ride horses and learning to catch horses and things like that. I wasn't thinking that it was kind of changing me, you know, at the maybe molecular level, you know.
That's an amazing story. I mean, you don't hear a story like that. Now, So why did they leave the South? When right. I mean, how long ago would that have been?
Right. I mean, people started. So my great grandparents were the first to move up
to Richmond.
Well, they started. They kind of bopped from Berkeley and in Oakland, and then ended up in Richmond.
Right.
You know, I think it was opportunity. I think it was.
Was it the turn of the century? Was it?
Like, no, you know, no. It was, you know, 40s, 50s.
Oh, 40s and 50s,
so around
okay.
the war, you know, this is right. Richmond is right. a, you know, a war town. We created Liberty ships. You know, we have the National Monument for Rosie the Riveter here because of the war effort and the contributions. Then people came up during that massive influx of blacks from the South, you know, during that time. And, you know, I think they were driven both because of just lack of opportunity. You know, they're not coming from big towns. They're coming from a town called Shady Grove, you know, northern Louisiana. I think, you know, the opportunity and the kind of, you know, oppressive situations. You know, there wasn't that opportunity was missing because of, you know, just racial oppression issues, you know, and so they looked to the West as a place where they could make something for themselves.
So they were farming, actually, when they lived in the country when they first
yeah,
came up here.
Absolutely.
And then they had to, did they have to leave the farm because they couldn't make enough money on the
yeah.
farm?
Yeah. They just, you know, it was always kind of subsistence-y, sell to the local town type of right. thing, not big farming operations. And, you know, more odd jobs and things like that to keep things mm-hmm. going. And but they had the skills, you know. Like, I remember, you know, some of the lessons, you know, my grandfather would teach mostly the boys, but I was kind of a renegade and would, you know, right. ramble behind them. You know, they were hardy, hardy people, kind of can do, we can do this together. And, you know, like, you don't hear that a lot, especially with African Americans pulling together in that way in the 60s and the 70s. That's when they bought the ranch and making a pretty massive impact on all of the families' lives.
So all these African-American families that moved up here, have they kept together? I mean, over the last 30, 40 years, do you still have contacts with those other families
yeah.
that moved up here?
We still have contacts, like I, especially now that social media is around.
Right, sure. yeah.
But it's, you know, my grandfather passed away maybe 8 years ago, and uh-huh. my grandmother just passed away last year. She was kind of the last keeper. Mm-hmm. And my uncle has kind of taken over the church, and it's not what it used to be. It's the same. It's kind of the same thing happening in African American churches across the country. Or you're, a lot of them are losing, you know, parishioners, and it's not as strong. I mean, we definitely all still know each other, and all still, when somebody passes, there's this massive gathering. You know,
right.
You know, when my grandfather passed, I think over 500 people came to the funeral. It's pretty intense. It's a struggle now. People's values have really changed. They don't understand land like the elders used to.
Yeah.
Like land before, for my grandfather's generation, all the elders there was just not an asset that you thought of in financial terms, you know.
Right.
It like, you know, you could sell it and, you know, buy a TV or something. They would have never thought that was a good idea.
Sure.
And so now the challenge is that people are wanting to break up, you know, the properties and the ranch and sell it and, you know, try to, you know, make short-term money. And it's sad. It's really sad.
So when did this occur to you that you would have this sort of a journey? I mean, you went to school, you grew up, you went to school in Richmond, and what were you thinking then? What were you thinking, what's going to happen to Doria?
Where
did you see yourself?
Right. I mean, honestly, when I was in high school and whatever, I was mostly thinking, how can I get out of Richmond? Like most people in Richmond, yeah. How do I get out of here? You know? But I think that what happened was, you know, I ended up going to a college on the East Coast. I got a scholarship to Hampshire College, and they had a organic farm there. And I spent a lot of time working on the farm. I don't know how I ended up there, but I remember doing, you know, sheeping one season, like helping with baby sheep birth, and, you know, a member of the Mixed Nuts Food Co-op, and joined the CSA there.
Right.
And I don't know, I just kind of fell into getting more and more involved with land and land issues, and kind of, you know, studying science, and started studying sustainability and poverty, just started thinking more and more about how poor people are kind of set up in terms of the way the economics of poverty works sure. to remain poor, you know, sure. because yeah. of lack of capital, lack of ability to invest in the way that, you know, actually brings cost of living down. And then just wondering, you know, well, what do I do with this? What do I do with this? What do I do with this? And I kind of went to into conservation work, and I was working with watershed restoration, kind of daylighting creeks and urban communities, and figuring right. that could be a way that people could reconnect with land, and realized it was a hard sell, you know, mm-hmm. when people are struggling just to have food on the table, keep the lights on, then it's hard for them to find time to volunteer. Like I didn't realize at that point what a luxury volunteering is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a luxury of time that a lot of poor people, even though they have time, but they have so much stress to get resources that their time is spent trying to get resources or suffering from, you know, the impact of not having resources. And so I just was like, you know, this is good, but it's not good enough. And then Park's email came across my computer with this vision around food and food access. And
what were you doing then when you got the email? What was your...
I was working for the Watershed Project, which is a watershed restoration sure. organization, uh-huh. education organization. Uh-huh. And my mission was actually to do watershed restoration work around Richmond and engage communities and you know, kind of bring that whole body of awareness into Richmond schools and transform landscapes, right? Because there's a lot of creeks that run through here, and they're mostly just, you know, destroyed. And yeah, and then that came across, and it just, at first it seemed weird, like why would somebody want to grow food in the city? And then it seemed genius, you know.
It is genius. And you know, again, your own journey, I just think about how your family moved up here from the South right. and how you, when you were growing up, you decided, you know, you couldn't see yourself in Richmond. You were probably going to be getting out of there like right. a lot of other people. And then you right. go off to college and study sustainable agriculture and get those experiences. And here you are.
Right. I mean, it came to a point where actually after college, I stayed with that whole thing of never, I'm not ever moving back to Richmond. What's there? And I moved to San Francisco and I lived there for a while. And I remember, you know, kind of making a good living for myself and, you know, doing all right, going to a lot of parties and everything. And then I looked up and I was like, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing? I am not needed here. You know, they don't need me. I'm not doing anything important. Anybody could do this. And I just kept looking kind of back at Richmond saying that I'm really, you know, that's where I'm needed. You know, that's where I need to be. And
You are making things happen here, but you also are getting support from, I suppose, some foundations and some others that are recognizing what you're doing and helping contribute to keeping this program going.
Right. We definitely, not at first. We definitely struggled for many, many years to, you know, keep things going and bootstrap things and, you know, did the best we could. But now we're getting a lot more support from major foundations. The California Endowment has been a major champion of our work over the years. The East Bay Community Foundation, San Francisco Foundation, Chorus Foundation now. Mm-hmm. And sunlight giving and other things like that. So it's been really gratifying to have worked so hard and have so many community members working so hard to make a positive change in our own community, and finally getting support from folks, you know, to keep that going. It is definitely makes it easier to keep going, you know.
Have you been able to get other people into doing similar things like you're mm-hmm. doing? I mean, people that have been involved in your program, they've either gone to other communities or taking on more leadership role here that have come through an experience with you.
Right. So many of the staff members who are now staff members started in our summer apprentice program, and they're 15, 16 years old. And, you know, kind of, it's a progressive program. So as you come back each year in the summer program, you take on more leadership. You know, you kind of work your way up the staff ladder from being an apprentice to a staff apprentice to a second on a site to a lead on a site, program manager. And then throughout the year, you can you know, you become eligible to be a full-time staff member or lead a farm or be a farm manager after you've been. If you've been around for 7 years, you know how these cycles, you know how the cycles work and you can lead. So there's definitely, I mean, I think almost all of the senior positions are former youth who are no longer youth who are leading leading our projects on the ground. It's awesome to actually also just live with people for that long, you know, to know 28, 32 people for 9 years through their development, through their changes, through having babies. Some people have gotten engaged to each other and like, we're going to have a wedding, you know, people have met each other here. That's the kind of work that's a part of this work that it's hard to describe.
Yeah.
You know, we're not just growing food. We really are growing community. You know, when I go out to different events in community, like last night I went out and maybe 6 or 7 people who were there are members of our CSA. And so they were like, oh, I loved what was in the box. You know, what are you going to do next? Are you going to grow this? Are you going to grow that? I just have never really experienced that kind of thing in Richmond before, where so many people are getting connected in this web around food, you know, and it's not just talk, it's real. You know, we know each other by the first name across neighborhoods. It's powerful.
Well, you know, your story is powerful, and I think about how you described Richmond as having kind of relatively high, I don't know if unemployment, but there's a lot of poverty, and they've had issues. It's in the middle of a large metro area. There's a lot of communities like Richmond around the country that don't have this going yet. I mean, you know, if somebody's listening to this and they think, I wish I could do something like that. I mean, what do you do first? I mean, if you're in a community like Richmond and you're, you know, somewhere back elsewhere in the United States, what do you tell people?
Where do you start?
How do you start?
Right. You find some friends first. Like, you can definitely be that lone person, that Park Guthrie. But, you know, Park took some hard hits and he couldn't stay with it because it was really hard on him just to do it all alone, you know? So find some friends, one or two who can be in it with you, and then find some land, you know? And what we do, all of our farms and gardens are on public land. So school district land, city land, county land, that's all not being used, you know?
Some of it, they let you use it, right?
Yes. I mean,
because we've talked to somebody in Sacramento that they've done that. There was actually a school that was being abandoned and nonprofits have gone in to take over the property and do interesting things and get a garden started.
Exactly. That's what Adams Crest Farm is. It's an abandoned middle school, Adams Middle School. They had to close it down because it was actually built on the earthquake fault and it just can't host kids in a public school there anymore. And that's where our first 1 acre farm is, on the old baseball field. So find some land, and you know, public land is for us it feels more possible because private owners can, you know, kind of change things on a, you know, you can build it up for a long time, build soil, and they're like, okay, I'm selling it now that you've made it beautiful. You can negotiate with kind of government entities. You can get political kind of community support to get political power to help them make a good decision. And actually here at our farm site, we were able to actually negotiate a 30-year lease with the county. So we actually, not only could we have a long-term lease, we also have permission to build all of the infrastructure that we need, and permanent buildings and other infrastructure to, you know, create an ongoing kind of farm resource center here. So, yeah.
Well, if people want to reach out to you and or they just want to know more about what you're doing at Urban Tilth, how do they contact you, or where do they find the information about?
Right. So we have a website. It's www.urbantilth.org, O-R-G. And we're really active on social media. So we have a Facebook account for Urban Tilth and Twitter and you know, Instagram. The kids do the Instagram. I think somebody started a Snapchat. I don't do that. And then you could just write us. You know, we're really personable. There's not a lot of layers. There's no layers of like interference. So, you know, literally it's Doria at Urban Tilth. Anybody that you know at Urban Tilth, first name at Urban Tilth. And, you know, there's also connections to us on our website.
Well, you are personable. I'm sitting here and having this conversation with you. We're at the farm, and as you're describing it, I can just see that glimmer in your eye that you're enthusiastic about what you do. Yeah. What makes you enthusiastic about the next several years? What are you most optimistic about when you're looking ahead?
Right. The prospects of growing and developing this farm site are kind of, for us, really mind-blowing. Even in the state that it's in now, we have some temporary gardens. We're really working soil on the back 2 acres, just building soil. That's all we're doing. We're not growing food yet. And we've had over 1,500 people come through, you know, volunteer, do different projects, host meetings. We've grown, you know, so much greens. People come through just to get harvest greens, and it's just powerful when people real, they're like, oh, there's a farm. And then they come, they go, oh my God, there is a farm. You know, so just the power that we're of this prospect of we're going to be able to do what we have been doing at the 7 other sites, at a whole other scale, is really inspiring. And, our CSA is really inspiring, you know, to be able to grow food for families that put it on their table and they send us pictures of their kids, and, you know, eating the apples or, you know, trying something for the first time, or their dog who also likes our CSA, you know, and then running out to, and, you know, seeing them out in the city, out in real life, and, you know, and having personal connections with hundreds of people. And next year we're wanting to double our membership. So the prospects of growing and strengthening that network of people, those bonds, is just heartening. I feel really grateful to be able to do this work.
Well, I tell you, the community is grateful. And there's a lot of people listening right now, too, that I think are grateful for your story and giving them something I think they can chew for, that they can apply their own community and find a way to get engaged and people and help a community. And Doria Robinson, I really appreciate your taking this time to being with me on Farm to Table Talk.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.